You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and really pleased to have with me once again James Rickards. And most of you probably do know James, but in the event that some of you are not familiar with his background, he is an economist, banker, lawyer, capital markets advisor for the Secretary of Defense and Intelligence Community. And James has been an advisor on international economics and financial threats to the Department of Defense and the U.S. intelligence community. He served as a facilitator for the first ever financial war games conducted by the Pentagon. And you may know him from his many books that he's written in the past. He's been on this show in the past to discuss most of them, I think. Currency Wars, The Death of Money, The New Case for Gold, The Road to Ruin. And Jim also publishes a very reasonably priced monthly newsletter that you should consider subscribing to as well. James Rickards, Strategic Intelligence, Making the Complex Simple. And I believe that you can generally buy James's stuff at his website at jamesrickardsproject.com. And I would also urge you to follow him on Twitter at James G. Rickards, at James G. Rickards. Follow him on Twitter as I do. I certainly try to keep up with him and all that he's thinking. A strategic thinker and one that is very valuable to us. So thank you so much, James, for coming on with us today.
Thank you, Jay. It's great to be with you.
It's really good to have you again. I just noted I do want to talk to you, of course, today about your new book, The New Great Depression, and you're telling me it's officially out on January 12th, but you can pre-order it, I guess, at Amazon and other places. So I would like to just ask you, well, I guess the subtitle was Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. Right. So, of course, I think most of our listeners want to be on the winning side of what happened. So we hope we can answer that question before we finish today. What should we be doing as best we can to prepare for the difficult times that lie ahead? But this book really focused to a very great extent on the pandemic. And, you know, James, I think you and I both believe that the country was in some financial difficulty before the pandemic. I think back to September of 2019 with the with the repo crisis seemed to be like a canary in the coal mine to me. But then along comes this pandemic. It was just really, it seems to be almost a nail in the coffin in a way. I want to ask you, there's a little note in the opening pages of the book from Revelation 15, the first verse. It says, and I quote, "And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God." So what messages, what images, what ideas did you want to get across by quoting that verse from Scripture?
Well, apart from the obvious biblical intent, Jay, it sort of makes the point that there's nothing new about plagues or pandemics.
Uh-huh.
The Book of Revelation was written, no one knows exactly when, but scholars estimate it was around 90 A.D. It was the last of the, it's not a gospel, it's part of the New Testament, but it's the last book of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
They say around 90 A.D., but there had been plagues long before that. There was a plague in Athens in the 5th century, in the mid-5th century, which was considered decisive in resolving the Peloponnesian War. That was between Athens and Sparta, and a plague broke out in Athens. Sparta won. That's brought up today in regard to China and the U.S. competing with each other, so a little bit of irony there. Emperor Justinian in the mid-6th century A.D. was in the process of reassembling the Roman Empire, reuniting the Western Empire with the Eastern Empire, and had conquered most of what had been lost in the West. But then there was the Justinian Plague, and it was devastating, lasted a long time, and at the time, Constantinople, and that was the end of that. So maybe the history of Europe would have been different. So you can go down through the ages, but plagues have happened, pandemics have happened, some worse than others. But the biggest ones, and I would say this COVID-19 pandemic is on its way to becoming one of the biggest ones in history, have changed history. You don't come out the other end. There is no normal. I make that point. We'll survive. We'll get through it. Life will go on. But it won't be normal. It'll be something different. We'll adapt to it. But that it's of that magnitude. That's the right way to think about it.
Yeah, and in your introduction, you wrote also another quote. I'd like to quote this little line that you wrote. You said, "This book is about a virus that caused a global depression. More precisely, it's about how our reaction to a virus caused a global depression. A virus can cause disease and pandemic, yet it cannot directly cause an economic collapse. That's up to us," end of quote. Which caused me, James, as a 73-year-old, to recall my youth, my early days in life, in the 1950s when we had the polio problem.
Right.
And, it was a horrible thing, and it was highly contagious. I remember they shut down the swimming pools. I can remember, the vaccinations came along. That was a godsend for sure. But, I mean, it was really horrible. People were living in iron lungs. In order to stay alive, they had to be placed in an iron lung and lay on their back. And, I mean, I remember people on crutches and people with, walking around. But a lot of people died. Yet we didn't freak out the way we have now. What do you think has changed? Why do you think that is, that we're freaking? We seem to be so fearful now. And maybe it's the difference between, a 7 or 8 year old and a 73-year-old. I don't know. But maybe it's the perception more than the reality. We did freak out.
Yes, some of it is medical, but I do think a lot of it is culture. I think you make a very good point, Jay. Some people call it the nanny state. We're so fearful of everything and this is before the pandemic. The pandemic is a greatly amplified example of it. But putting rubber mats on playgrounds. Well, okay, nobody wants their kid to fall off the monkey bars. I don't even think they have monkey bars. We used to have them. We swing around like monkeys. But no one wants their kid to fall off the monkey bar and break his arm on an asphalt pavement. But I think people do take it too far, and the pandemic is no different. When I started writing the book, by the way, I had this debate with my editor, and my editor is great, and my publisher has been very supportive, so we have a good relationship, but we go back and forth on certain things. And when we started this book last April, they said, "Well, Jim, we want you to write about the depression, the economy. You're good at that. We know you have good ways of handling that. But don't talk about the pandemic so much because you're not a doctor." And I said two things. I said, number one, that's like asking me to write about property damage in New Orleans in 2005 and not mention Hurricane Katrina. I said, you just can't talk about the depression. It's the result of the pandemic, so you can't separate them. You have to talk about it. And by the way, I said, look, I went to Johns Hopkins. I'm not intimidated by natural science. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an immunologist. I'm not an epidemiologist. But I did find that the science was accessible. I read over 100 peer-reviewed academic papers. These are not newspaper articles or fringe theories. This was stuff from the Lancet Journal of New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association, other top-tier publications. So I jumped into that, had some acquaintance with it. So I found it, I found it accessible. And when I started, I thought, well, this is going to be straightforward. There's going to be a bunch of like fringe theories and crazy theories and stuff like that over here, and there's going to be solid science over there, and I'll stick to the solid science. That turned out not to be true. The fringe theories were there, and I was able to discard them. But when I got into the science, the first thing I discovered is that scientists don't agree with each other.
Right.
I can quote papers, and they're in the book. They're all in the end notes, where one scientist will say, you must wear a mask. You're a fool if you go outside without a mask. It's the key to stopping the pandemic, et cetera. I can show you another paper, also by a PhD epidemiologist, who said masks don't work. The virus is so small, it goes right through the fibers. It's all for show. Unless you're sneezing and coughing or you're in an operating room, there's really no point wearing a mask, and people don't wear them correctly anyway. I lean to the latter view. Look, I go to a store, you want a mask, I wear a mask. I don't argue with people about it, and I have no problem with that. But there's serious doubt about whether masks do any good. But I present both sides in the book. And again, I tease people. I say, well, the book's well worth it, and I hope you buy it, and I hope you read it and enjoy it. But the purchase price alone, you should pay that much just for the endnotes. because the endnotes are, there are hundreds of them. And if you read, if there's something in the book you disagree with, I say, don't argue with me. Go check out the footnote and argue with that scientist, because I wasn't making things up. I was pulling it from science. So, but there's a lot of disagreement. I did come down on the side that lockdowns don't work. That evidence is very clear. Lockdowns do not work to stop the spread of the virus. They do work to destroy the economy. They're very good at that. But they're not doing anything for the virus. And, you know, case in point, we locked down in a severe, I would say extreme way, in last March, April, May 2020. And everyone said, okay, yeah, but by June, July, you know, it'll be over. We'll lock it down and we'll kind of starve the virus and all this stuff. And they reopened the economy to some extent. Well, guess what? By October, the caseloads were higher. The fatalities were higher. The virus was spreading more rapidly. That's where we are today, by the way. Mm-hmm. I know the vaccine's out there, but the virus is spreading faster than the vaccine can be administered. So we're losing the race right now. Well, that's what you would have predicted if you know that lockdowns don't work, and they don't. So, you know, there's a good argument that we would have been better off. Look, some things are fine. Wash your hands, yes. Wear a mask, yes. Social distancing, no one disputes that. Mm-hmm. Avoid, you know, don't have a stadium full of football fans or whatever. Mm-hmm. That all makes sense. But locking down bars, restaurants, nail salons, dry cleaners, boutiques, you know, people look down their noses at that because they're all invested in, you know, Apple and Amazon, Netflix, and all that, and I understand how that works. But small and medium-sized businesses are 50% of jobs and 45% of GDP. Mm-hmm. You cannot whack that sector of the economy without destroying the economy, and that's what we've done.
Mm-hmm. We have all the money in the world, but you can't find a good restaurant to go to. I don't know. I mean, to me, yeah. It's what's it all about? If you get rid of the middle class, which was underway dramatically before COVID-19, right. And now it seems to have accelerated it. And you know, as you say the mainstream media is telling us to follow the science. And I dare say, and I know some of the sources that you're talking about, there are credible scientists that disagree with the mainstream theme here. So it is very disturbing to me, James, that that the media is suppressing a dissent on these things, and it's become so politicized. It seems this whole thing has become so politicized. It's a very sad day in our history that we're not. And the First Amendment. I want to ask you. I mean, are you troubled by? It seems as though an effective lockdown or shutdown of our First Amendment rights in this country.
I agree with that. I'm very troubled by it. And you're right, Jay. Whenever I hear anyone say follow the science, mm-hmm. my first thought is you're not a scientist. You don't understand science. Because if you really, when people say, well, the question's settled, scientists have settled the question.
Right.
That's nonsense. I mean, Einstein didn't think Newton had settled it. Niels Bohr didn't think Einstein had settled it. And we're still arguing about it today. Good scientists will be the first ones to say, look, here's my theory. Here's my experimental evidence. But, you know, if I'm wrong, tell me. Or if you've got a different experimental result, tell me. And the good ones will, when they're contradicted or something, some flaw turns up, they'll say, they'll go, you know what, I was wrong. We're going to start again. Here we go. That's good science. And those are the scientists you should respect. Whenever anyone says science is settled, they don't know anything about science.
Yeah, that's, we've heard it with different topics, not just COVID-19, but we're hearing it. And it's just troubling to me that people aren't allowed to speak. People with different ideas than is what is politically correct. It's a new America from that perspective, and I judge you know, from what you're saying and what you're quoting in your book, we better get used to it, because this is going to be a different landscape no matter when we're out of the pandemic as well. But well, then what about?
One of the points I make in the book, I say the virus is not a Republican or a Democrat. The virus just wants to kill you. Yeah. And that's really all you need to know. So you can politicize it if you want to, but that's not helping deal with the pandemic.
So let's talk about the economy a little bit. Another quote, actually, this is Mohammed El-Erian that you put in your book. Only a few months into the tragic COVID-19 shock, there are already concerns that Wall Street is once again flourishing while Main Street is suffering. If current asset prices fail to be validated by a decisive economic recovery, the longer-term well-being, not just of the economy and markets, but of institutions and society is as well, will be at risk, end of quote. So how do you think that reconciliation will take place? There has to be a reconciliation somewhere along. Will we see an equity market meltdown that brings these very wealthy people down? Or will we actually see, the better answer would be, of course, somehow growth again in the economy so that the real economy catches up with these inflated market prices?
Well, it's one or the other, and I do talk about that specifically in Chapter 6 of the book. And Muhammad Al-Erian's an interesting figure because, pardon me, he's a real honest-to-goodness power elite. I mean, he's a Davos, he's talking to the central bankers, et cetera.
Yes.
So he's the real deal. But I also find him very sensible and down-to-earth, and most of the elites are not. So he's one I actually think is worth listening to. But what this is, Jay, what you're pointing to in Chapter 6, I talk about the difference between perception and reality. Reality, you should be able to figure out through math or science or observation or anecdotal evidence, etc. Perception is just what people think, whether they're right or wrong. Well, whenever that gap opens up between perception and reality, reality always wins, but not right away. It can take a while for that gap to close. But meanwhile, if you can identify it, and I have done that in Chapter 6, pardon me, you can make a lot of money because if you, in effect, buy the reality and wait for the perception to converge, own the gap between perception and reality, that's an enormous profit potential. Now, timing matters. It can get worse before it gets better. You got to be careful about that. And, again, watch the, my hedge fund days, the mark to market. You got to keep an eye on that. But it will come down to earth now. So what's the reality? The reality is what we talked about before. You know, people look down their nose at small businesses. They go, well, you're not Apple, you're not Netflix, you're not Microsoft, you're just a restaurant or a bar. But apart from the condescension built into that, again, as I say, small businesses are 50% of the economy. So so you lock it down, you've destroyed your economy, and that's what we're doing. We're doing it again, by the way. I expect a second recession in the first quarter, beginning in the first quarter of 2021, right now, in other words. This will be the first back-to-back recession since 1980-81. We went into recession in February 2020. That's my view, but it's also what the National Bureau of Economic Research said. They're the referees. We were out of it by the third quarter because growth was positive 33% approximately in the third quarter. So the first and second quarter were your recession. We're out of it. We're going back into a recession right now because the virus is out of control and we're locking down again, even though lockdowns don't work. Now, as far as the perception is concerned, everyone's like, yeah, but, you know, the stock market dropped a little over 30% in from late February to late March. I think March 23rd was the bottom. But it came back 70%. Stock market indices are at an all-time high. My 401k is back, et cetera. Well, that's all true, but understand what the stock market is. It's completely divorced from economic reality, number one. Number two, you can talk about the S&P 500, but it's really the S&P 7. We know who they are. It's Apple, Microsoft, Netflix, Facebook, Google, or Alphabet, Tesla is the new entry. They just threw Tesla in the index as well. So those seven stocks are four, because the S&P 500 is a cap-weighted index, meaning your influence on the index is based on your market capitalization. Mm-hmm. Well, those seven stocks are 40% of the total capitalization of the S&P 500. So whatever they do, that's what the index does. And then people are investing passively, so they just say to their broker, Vanguard, Fidelity, whoever it is, get me an index fund. Okay, well, if you put money in an index fund and that bids up the price, guess what? More people put money in the index fund and it bids up the price more. And so you get into this feedback loop or recursive function, and then ETFs are no better because they're just little mini indices. So between passive investing, index funds, ETFs, and this concentration in, again, seven names, what about the other, what about the S&P 493? What about the other 493 stocks that are not in the big seven? Mm-hmm. Break them out. You can do it. It's not hard to do. They're flat to down. Yeah, there are some individual cases that vary, but that overall part of the index isn't doing anything. Right. So the stock market is divorced from reality. The seven companies I mentioned are very far removed. They're the least affected by the pandemic. I mean, Netflix is doing great because everyone's staying home watching Netflix. Amazon's doing great because everyone's afraid to go to the store, and so forth. So Best Buy, I was in Best Buy recently. I bought a new TV set, and I just said to the salesman, I like to chat people up. I said, How's business? He goes, better than ever. He said, because nobody can go out. So they're all in here buying TVs and stereos. And I said, yeah, that makes sense. So you do have these sectors that are doing well, but half the economy is being crushed. So, and they've had people like Larry Kudlow running around in the spring talking about pent-up demand, which is nonsense. I mean, as soon as I heard that, I thought of green shoots. Remember green shoots in 2009?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, there was brown weeds, right. But so pent-up demand, so what does that mean? So my wife and I like to go out to dinner on a Friday night. So during the first quarantine or lockdown from, you know, March, April, May of 2020, we didn't go out to dinner. We just kind of hung out and ate at home. So by June, things had reopened, some things, and we went out to dinner. Well, I didn't order 10 dinners. I ordered one, like I usually do. In other words, the 9 dinners I skipped in the previous 2 months, that was permanently lost. There's no pent-up demand there. Mm-hmm. Those dinners aren't coming back. That's a permanent loss. And when you close a restaurant, let's say you have 20, you know, waiters, waitresses, and bartenders, and you reopen, maybe, you don't bring back all 20. You bring back 10 because your capacity is reduced to 50% at most, and people aren't going out to dinner anyway. That's if you were lucky to reopen. What the other thing that's being missed is that everyone says, oh, they shut down, but they'll reopen, pent-up demand, all this stuff, which is nonsense. They're not reopening. The bankruptcies are sky high. And by the way, this is not speculation, Jay. There's good data on this. You can go to Yelp.
Absolutely.
Yelp, like if I close my business, I take my page off of Yelp. Well, they've identified 900,000 businesses that have shut down.
All right, Jim, we're just about out of time already, and I want to ask you, how you mentioned the third quarter was positive. We got out of the recession, but that was done by a lot of deficit spending, huge amounts of deficit spending.
Right.
And it seems to me, I'm wondering, where is the financing going to come from? It's going to come from the printing press, is it not? Alistair McLeod pointed out that in 2 weeks in December, there's 14% growth in M1. A lot of that is shifting from M2 to M1, and the Fed is now starting to report it differently, apparently. But the point is that do you see any way that this can be financed? Foreign money coming in? How are we going to finance this? And is there any way other than just printing money to finance it?
The financing part is easy. The bigger question is, can you get growth out of it? In other words, the Fed keeps saying zero interest rates and money printing is stimulus. Well, no, it's zero interest rates and money printing. You can print money, and they do, and they have $3 trillion worth since the pandemic. But there's no stimulus in it. And that's because money printing has nothing to do with inflation. Mm-hmm. Money does not cause inflation. Velocity causes inflation. That's the turnover of money. So print all the money you want. And, you know, my friend Stephanie Kelton, she's the big brain of modern monetary theory. And by the way, she's a very big voice in the Biden administration because she was financial advisor to Bernie Sanders. She says, yeah, you went from $4 trillion to $7 trillion, you can go to $10 trillion. Well, legally you can, and they might, but it won't work because you print the money. So how do you print the money? Well, the Fed buys treasury notes from the primary dealers, and the dealers send the notes in. The Fed sticks them on the balance sheet, and the Fed pays you in money in your bank account. Well, what do the banks do with the money? They give it back to the Fed in the form of excess reserves.
Yeah.
So it's not being, there's no lending, there's no spending, there's no turnover, there's no velocity, and that means no stimulus.
And the real economy is basically dead. Now, I should mention that we're out of time, Jim, but I should mention that you do have some optimistic notes at the end. You noted that FDR, we had a very divisive country before World War II, but FDR, who was a socialist president, came together and worked with Henry Ford. So there are some notes of hope in your book. But I think it's a very realistic book, and I really hope people go out and buy a copy of it because I think it's very well worthwhile. People need to be ready for what's coming because I think we're going to be looking at some very difficult times ahead. I want to thank you so much, James, for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you, and always be glad to have you back anytime you have the time to be with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, Chen Lin, Brent Cook, Eric Coffin, Gwen Preston, all newsletter writers, analysts, will be picking their top stocks for this year. Peter Ball of NV Gold will be with me as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
No. Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.